And welcome to today's program. I'm Dr. Prithvi Bose, an associate professor in the Department of Leukemia at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. And I'm joined today by Dr. Andrew Kirkendall, assistant professor in the Department of Malignant Hematology at the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida. These are our disclosures. So today we're going to discuss the management of myelofibrosis essentially in the second and later line setting after a failure of ruxolitinib. As you know, there are three JAK inhibitors that are FDA approved today: ruxolitinib, fedratinib, and pacritinib. And all have been approved on the basis of pivotal trials that have demonstrated consistent improvements in spleen volume, disease symptoms, and quality of life. However, at the same time, data shows that there is a high frequency of discontinuation because of either adverse events or more frequently progressive disease that lead to poor outcomes, with survival after ruxolitinib discontinuation only in the range of 11 to 14 months across a number of studies. So today, our learning objectives will focus on describing the clinical practice considerations for the use of new second-line therapies for the treatment of myelofibrosis, the latest data on emerging and investigational second-line therapies for the treatment of myelofibrosis, and in summary, we will review what we believe could be the emerging treatment paradigm and sort of best practices in this era where there are options beyond first-line ruxolitinib, and trying to best manage patients with identified resistance or intolerance to ruxolitinib. So sort of on that note, and I was alluding to this when I said that survival in the post-ruxolitinib discontinuation setting is only in the range of 11 to 14 months. This was work from our group at MD Anderson showing a median survival after rux discontinuation of 14 months, and very similar results have been reported by others, including Dr. Kirkendall from Moffitt and other groups as well. And this just shows you that after you discontinue ruxolitinib, there were two factors, at least in our study, that predicted for even worse outcomes. And one was platelets dropping while on ruxolitinib, and the other was clonal evolution on ruxolitinib. Now that brings us to this new model published earlier this year in Blood Advances that Dr. Kirkendall and colleagues from Italy really developed, and I'll let him speak to this. This may be a way of helping clinicians decide which patients may not do so well on ruxolitinib and perhaps may need to switch. Andrew?
Thanks, Prithvi. And I think that for a long time we've known that we've had these agents that do a great job at improving symptoms and spleen, but the question is when is the right time to switch therapies or to consider an alternative treatment approach? And I think this is something that we've struggled with. I think myelofibrosis is very different than some other diseases that we treat, where you get true deep responses and then maybe you lose a response and then you know it's time to switch to something else. And I think it's a little bit more nuanced with myelofibrosis. And so this was a model that I think what was great about this is it largely confirmed things we already knew, but it looked at factors that occur in patients that have been treated with ruxolitinib that predict for worse overall survival. And really the three things that came out that predicted for this worse survival were being on suboptimal doses of ruxolitinib, so being on less than 20 milligrams twice a day, which we know is a very effective dose, and we also know that a lot of the spleen responses at least are dose dependent. And so being on lower doses predicted for worse overall outcomes, needing red blood cell transfusions throughout therapy, and having a less than 30% reduction in palpable splenomegaly, so really a suboptimal spleen response. And I think this highlights what we've seen before with ruxolitinib therapy, is that patients that can't get on a higher dose, patients that need a lot of transfusions, have a lot of cytopenias, and those that don't get a great spleen response really aren't getting the maximum benefit from rux therapy. And I think this model helps us to really identify those patients who may benefit from a change in treatment approach. And so as we start to look into second line treatments, I want to quickly set the stage for this discussion, because in recent years, there's this stringent criteria for ruxolitinib failure that has been adopted, because we need to kind of study this across different studies. And we've needed to incorporate this into the more recent clinical trials. But just because these are what we use in trials doesn't mean that it always carries over into what we do in the real world practice. I'd kind of pose this question back to you, Prithu. What do you think about this kind of widely accepted definition of what we see with ruxolitinib failure on clinical trials? And what do you use in practice?
In clinical practice, I don't think it's necessarily practical to apply those in a strict fashion, especially recognizing that progression can occur in so many ways, right? I mean, you could have leukocytosis worsening, blasts going up, symptoms worsening. So it's not just about the spleen, and certainly cytopenias worsening. So I think it comes down to an overall assessment of disease progression by the treating physician, because it comes in so many flavors.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that obviously, I always think about what are our goals of treatment with JAK inhibitors and ruxolitinib specifically, and a lot of times it's improving symptoms and spleen. So if those things are getting worse, then I think it's a lot easier to say that maybe there is some failure going on. But there's a lot of other aspects of the disease that can be worsening, in spite of that. So patients can just have profound cytopenias that become very problematic. And maybe that wouldn't have been considered a failure when we didn't have any other option. But as clinical trials have emerged and newer agents are being developed that may address those, you start to think, okay, well, maybe that is some sort of a failure because we have more options. So I think it's context dependent as well. So we do want to go through looking at some of these second line or alternative options. And I think one of the ones, the first agent that emerges as a potential second line option is fedratinib. And obviously this is approved agnostic to line of therapy. And so this can be used in the front line or second line setting. But the data that emerged for second line use comes from this Jakarta 2 study, which looked at fedratinib in patients that had previously been exposed to ruxolitinib. And recently this has actually been reanalyzed using a more stringent criteria for ruxolitinib failure, whereas in the initial analysis it wasn't clear if it was really an accepted definition. And so when it was reanalyzed, the definition of relapse and refractory were very rigidly defined to mean, for relapse disease they had to have received ruxolitinib for at least 3 months and had to have regrowth of the spleen size following an initial response, and then for refractory, there had to have been at least 3 months with a suboptimal spleen response, so somewhere between 10 and 30% decrease, not meeting a true response there. So there was clear definitions for refractory and relapsed. And then there was intolerance, which this gets into kind of the cytopenia side of things, when you talk about treatment for at least 1 month or 28 days that was complicated by the development of red blood cell transfusions, or grade 3 or higher thrombocytopenia, anemia, development of bleeding or hematomas while receiving ruxolitinib. So I think this kind of covers multiple different aspects of quote-unquote treatment failure. You have patients that got a response that then they lost. They didn't have an optimal response, or those that really had treatment that was complicated by the development of low platelets, anemia, transfusions, bleeding, which would mean that an alternative option would be reasonable. And when they reanalyzed this study using these stringent criteria, 8 out of 10, 80% or so of patients met the stringent criteria for Rux relapse refractory. And then within this, you saw that the spleen volume responses in the second line setting were up to 30%, symptom response rate 27%, suggesting this does have activity as a second line agent. When you look at fedratinib and you look at the waterfall plots, this was a single arm study, and these are the waterfall plots looking at improvements in spleen and symptoms in both the initial intention to treat population as well as looking at the stringent criteria cohorts. And what we can highlight here is if the bars are going down from zero down, that's an improvement in both spleen and then symptoms on the right. And you can see that most patients had improvement in their spleen and symptom scores, with very few patients having worsening of these disease. So there does seem to be activity here. And then when you actually look at you know, this kind of critical cohort of lower platelet patients, right? This is a patient population that we know is a challenge to treat, especially with ruxolitinib, because we have to alter doses for this. But if you look at those patients that were enrolled on Jakarta-2 that had platelet count between 50 and 100,000, that was 33 patients, which is not an insignificant number of folks. And the spleen volume response within this cohort was 36%, symptom response 38%. So really did show the ability to achieve these kind of critical responses in a very, I would say suboptimally treated cohort historically. What's notable about this is it's, you actually see better spleen responses and symptom responses, you know, nominally than you see in patients that have higher platelet counts. And I think that can be somewhat confusing, but I would also say that that might be the patient population that's more likely to benefit from a switch, right? Because these are the patients that are going to be more suboptimally dosed on ruxolitinib and then can be fully dosed on fedratinib. And so it may be that these patients with marginal platelet counts have the ability or more chance to benefit by switching to the full dose of an alternative JAK inhibitor. Which brings us to talk about pacritinib. Pacritinib recently gained accelerated approval in February of this year, really for this markedly thrombocytopenic patient population, less than 50,000 platelets. And the data that for that came from several studies, but really predominantly from this PERSIST-2 study, where it enrolled patients with platelets less than 100,000 and treated them with two different doses of pacritinib. We'll really focus on the 200 milligram twice daily dose because that's the dose that's recommended going forward, and compared them to best available therapy, which included ruxolitinib. Again, this included ruxolitinib at a suboptimal dosing strategy, right? So lower doses of ruxolitinib for these patients with less than 100,000 platelets. And then compared their spleen responses and symptom responses in this kind of thrombocytopenic patient cohort. And what you can see here when looking at spleen volume reductions is the patients treated with pacritinib 200 milligrams twice a day consistently had reduction in their spleen volume, and it seems superior to that of best available therapy, which is on the far right portion of this, where we did see reduction in the spleen volumes, but not as consistently and not as profound. And the orange bars in the best available therapy cohort identify those patients that were treated with ruxolitinib at a lower dose. And so you can see that there's a general trend for those patients to have improvement in spleen volume, but certainly not to the extent that we saw with the pacritinib cohort. And again, when we look at symptoms in the same way, you start to see a similar picture emerge. Again, ignoring kind of that left graph, which is focusing on pacritinib at 400 milligrams daily and focusing more on the middle with pacritinib 200 milligrams twice daily, we can see consistent declines in symptom scores, improvements in symptoms greater than what we see with best available therapy. And I think this is a chance to bring Prithvi back in, because I think, you know, we think about pacritinib in treating patients that have marked thrombocytopenia. And so I think this analysis, which was recently presented in poster format at EHA earlier this year, really kind of focused on that question and said, okay, what about pacritinib versus ruxolitinib in patients with thrombocytopenia? And let's look across the board and see how they do. And I think when they look at spleen volume response, symptom score, and overall global impression of change, which is this kind of patient-reported outcome of how they feel, pacritinib seems superior across the board to ruxolitinib in these patients with lower platelets. So Prithvi, is this where you see pacritinib being used the most? Is this something you would limit to less than 50,000 platelets? Or where do you see pacritinib, and what do you think of this analysis?
Yeah, Andrew, these are compelling data. You know, like you said, the label for pacritinib is less than 50, but obviously this study was done in patients with platelets up to 100, like you said, and Rux was allowed as BAT. And clearly this is what we are showing here, the PAC patients versus the patients who got Rux as their BAT. Now, being mindful of the fact that some also had prior Rux. Right, so I think the appeal of this is clearly there, that the spleen response was actually significantly superior for PAC. Symptoms were certainly numerically superior. Now, I think the only caveat is, Andrew, like you said, that the Rux dose was generally 5 milligrams once or twice a day for these patients. And so I think in the 50 to 100 segment, I think one could really go both ways. But clearly, pacritinib has established itself as an attractive option there at the 200 BID. Again, full dosing to your point, as opposed to suboptimal dosing. But I think 10 milligram BID of Rux is also a reasonable strategy. And one that we have employed, when PAC was not an option. So I think both of those, but certainly I think favoring PAC based on this comparison.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point there, and we're kind of limited by the label of Rux, because I think when we've kind of gotten more bold on our dosing of ruxolitinib in these kind of marginal thrombocytopenic patients, where we feel like we can maybe try to get to these higher doses, 10 milligrams twice a day, can even push the dose in patients that aren't dropping their platelets as markedly. But when you're looking at this on a clinical trial, you certainly have to follow the label. And so sometimes this requires us to take a little bit, we have to kind of be very nuanced and thoughtful in how we interpret this data and really consider that, yes, patients who cannot tolerate more than 5 milligrams twice a day, pacritinib clearly appears to be better. However, it may not be a completely fair comparison, as we can push the dose of Rux probably a little bit more aggressively in some of these patients. Which brings us to kind of the most recently developed JAK inhibitor, which is momelotinib. Not currently approved, but have reported positive results from a recently completed phase 3 clinical trial called Momentum. And momelotinib has kind of a complicated history, but essentially it was looked at in two studies called the Simplify studies that identified that it had significant activity as far as reducing spleen and symptom improvement, but also had this ability to improve anemia that we hadn't really seen in prior JAK inhibitors. And so altogether, it was assessed in this Momentum study that looked at patients that had previously been on ruxolitinib for at least 28 days, and then who were anemic and had big spleens, and it randomized them 2-1 to either momelotinib versus danazol, which is certainly another agent that we use in the salvage setting for anemic patients with myelofibrosis. And it looked at a primary endpoint of symptom improvement at 24 weeks. Of course, the primary endpoint may have been symptom improvement, but there's also these key secondary endpoints looking at spleen response rate and transfusion independence as well at week 24. So really trying to get the understanding, is this an agent that's able to help with multiple things? Can it not only help with symptoms, but can it also help with anemia issues as well as spleen response rates? And what was found was quite exciting in the sense that when we look, and you can see these waterfall plots here are heavily weighted toward the momelotinib because it was a 2-1 randomization. So twice as many patients went on the momelotinib arm as the danazol arm. But when you look at the symptom response rate at week 24, you had 25% of patients able to achieve this 50% reduction in symptom score compared to just 9% on the danazol arm, and that was statistically significant. What we also saw in terms of spleen response rates is that 40% of patients were able to achieve these 25% reduction in spleen volume, 23% able to achieve this kind of classical 35% reduction in spleen volume. Very few patients on the danazol arm were able to achieve this degree of spleen response. So quite effective in comparison with danazol in terms of spleen and symptoms. And then when we look at the rate of anemia and those kind of anemia parameters, we look at transfusion independence. This is something that's clinically meaningful to patients. At baseline, around 13-15% of patients on either arm were transfusion independent. However, at week 24, you had 30%, slightly more, that were transfusion independent on the momelotinib arm compared to only 20% on the danazol arm, suggesting an improvement in this rate of transfusion independence when treated with momelotinib. And then when you look at the overall just kind of mean hemoglobin over time in this line graph here, you can see that those patients treated with momelotinib had this initial peak in their hemoglobin and then that maintained and that stayed stable throughout. At week 24, I'd highlight those patients on the gray line who were treated with danazol actually switched over to momelotinib, and you can then see in those next 24 weeks that actually that gray line starts to meet the momelotinib arm, suggesting that those patients who switched then from damizole to momelotinib then had a subsequent improvement in their hemoglobin or mean hemoglobin over time. And so I think that this is certainly very exciting data, and I think this is kind of covering these kind of more novel JAK inhibitors that can be used in the second line setting. And so I'll get some quick thoughts from Prithvi, but also turn it over to him to discuss some non-JAK inhibitor options.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. So this is imetelstat, so a little bit of a different direction here for the rest of the content today. So these are non-JAK inhibitors, of course. This is the telomerase inhibitor. And this is just to remind you, and Dr. Kirkendall showed you earlier, sort of the definition of or stringent criteria for RUX failure in the Jakarta 2 reanalysis of edratinib. So note that here is another set of criteria. These were used in the phase 2 trial of imetelstat that looked at two different doses, as you see. This is an IV drug given every 3 weeks. And note that the criteria, like I was saying earlier, are similar but not the same. They're sort of variations around the theme of an insufficient spleen response or regrowth after an initial response. Moving on from there, now this drug has been particularly exciting because of what you see in the top row there, the median overall survival in this post JAK inhibitor setting was a striking 28.1 months at the higher dose. This is about double of what, for example, our group reported that I showed you earlier, 14 months in the post-RUX failure setting. Symptom and spleen responses were not as impressive, certainly not spleen. However, you note on the table also that if you look at the bottom, the reduction in bone marrow fibrosis and driver mutation allele burden was again quite striking at above 40% for both of those parameters. Again, I already covered this, but the main message that got folks interested in this particular drug and actually served as the impetus to design the phase 3 that's currently ongoing with overall survival as the primary endpoint. This is a first in the field. We don't have another phase 3 that used OS as its primary endpoint. Was this, that in the phase 2 they saw this 28-month, in excess of 28-month overall survival in the second-line setting after RUX failure. Now, there is another drug that is being investigated in a similar setting. It's called naftimadlin, has a name now, was previously called KRT232. This is a MDM2 inhibitor. So naftimadlin is also being studied as a single agent against best supportive care or best available therapy, I should say, in the post-JAK inhibitor failure setting. So similar to imetelstat, however, what they another thing that they share in common, the two phase 3 trials, I mean, is that other JAK inhibitors are actually not allowed in the comparator arm. So it's imetelstat versus best available therapy and naftimadlin versus best available therapy, excluding JAK inhibitors. But this goes back, this particular slide goes back to the phase 2 trial of this agent, and this was again done in a JAK inhibitor resistant refractory population, not an intolerant population. They actually excluded intolerance. So that was a little bit more of a pure homogeneous failure population in the sense that these patients were not having enough of a spleen response. And I'm showing you some of the early results here presented at EHA 2020, so some time ago now. If you look to the left, because that's the dose that's going forward, the 240 milligrams for a week and then 3 weeks off, that is the dose and schedule going forward. So if you look there, the spleen response was a modest 14%. However, there was no washout from RUX in this study. And when you do that, what can obviously happen is that the spleen could grow after the patient stops the RUX and thereby diminish the apparent benefit from the new drug. And so they looked at also patients who had been off Rux already at the time that they began naftamadlin, and for them the spleen response was better at 24%. Obviously small numbers here. Symptoms, similar story, 33% across the board and 38% when you looked at just the patients that were off Rux. Now, moving on from there to a slightly different theme here, the concept of add-on therapy. So we now have a profusion actually of agents that are synergistic in the lab with ruxolitinib, which has given rise to this idea of adding them on in patients with so-called suboptimal responses to ruxolitinib. So shown here is the BCL-XL, BCL-2 inhibitor navitoclax, which was studied in this fashion. These combos have been studied in frontline as well. We won't touch on that in today's presentation, but this is the suboptimal setting. And here patients had to have had at least 3 months of prior Rux, and frankly, it was a lot longer. The median prior Rux duration was like 20 months. So it was people who had been on Rux for a good amount of time and, you know, had not had a sufficient spleen and symptom response. And there you saw about a 30% rate of symptom response and 27% rate of spleen response. And by that, I mean the typical TSS50 and SVR35 with the addition of navitoclax. Similar data with pelabresib. Pelabresib is the BET inhibitor, and this again has been studied in frontline as well as in the add-on setting, actually also as monotherapy in the second line setting. But this is again the add-on data. Remember, these are all synergistic combinations preclinically. And here we saw about a 20% rate of spleen response and a 37% rate of symptom response in the add-on setting, folks who had been on Rux for at least 6 months and still had a palpable spleen greater than 5 cm or a certain volume by MRI, etc. This drug also has an anemia benefit, and if you look towards the bottom in the transfusion independent patients, there was a conversion of 16% to independence, and then the patients who were anemic but not transfusion dependent by formal criteria, there was a 22% anemia response. So potentially a drug that can benefit multiple aspects of the disease. Finally, luspatercept, a different kind of combination in the sense that this is viewed as primarily an anemia drug and not necessarily a synergistic one in preclinical studies, but just a logical empiric combination. Luspatercept obviously is familiar to all of you from its use in MDS and beta thalassemia. And in this trial, somewhat of a complicated design, but really 4 cohorts, patients could be on Rux or not be on Rux, and they could be formally transfusion dependent or transfusion independent. And luspatercept was added to the Rux in those cohorts, as well as used as monotherapy in the folks not on Rux. And really, to summarize the results, the best results were seen in the patients who were on a stable dose of ruxolitinib and transfusion dependent. That is where it seemed to provide the greatest benefit, which again served as the stimulus for the phase 3 study that's currently ongoing, comparing luspatercept to placebo in patients on a stable dose of Rux and requiring transfusions. So that's ongoing at this time. So we've tried today, I think, to sort of summarize very quickly what is a plethora of new agents being developed, both JAK inhibitors and non-JAK inhibitors in this space. Andrew, any final thoughts?
No, I think that's a great job, Prithvi. I think certainly this is becoming an emerging area, and I think we're getting more and more options. I think critically we do need to think about what can we do for the patient, what's the most what's the individual goal we have for patients that are sitting in front of us, and really try to target the therapy that we consider with the individual patient goals. This should always be an individualized decision with these goals in mind.
Thanks, Andrew. Thank you all for listening. This will conclude our presentation for today.